Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle.
Sometimes cross-country skiing.
And sometimes cross-country skiing.
We can't let that one slip by this morning.
We can't. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Are we going to mention
Yeah, it's so exciting. I can hardly talk about it. I'll start crying.
First ever Olympic medal. Not only first ever Olympic medal, but a gold for Keegan Randall and Jesse Diggins of the women's cross-country team in the team sprints this morning.
In the team sprints.
Happened
wow.
in the wee hours of the morning, and they've been playing it delayed, but, you know, as live as we can get. And I had to turn off the finals to come do this interview. So,
well, it's all okay. But watching their finish, we watched what they replayed about the last 20 seconds.
Yeah, there's a clip as
or
they
so.
Come into the...
Jesse Diggins passing the girls from Norway and Sweden. Absolutely astonishing.
And that
She's
will be
a little
on,
thing, too.
That will be on primetime this evening, I'm sure, that starts at 6 o'clock. They'll do that somewhere in that... 6 o'clock review. But yeah, she's from Minnesota, Afton, Minnesota.
So exciting.
And then Keegan Randall, she got her start here at 2002 Olympics in Salt Lake.
And she took a break for a year in 2016 to have a baby. So that's a great role model for all those women out there who wonder, can they come back after having babies? Yep. Oh yeah, they can. Gold medal status.
So today in the program, we join journalist and writer Michael Finkel as he tells the true story of 20-year-old Chris Knight, who in 1986 walked into the Maine woods to live as a hermit for 27 years before he was arrested for stealing food from a camp. Finkel has written a fascinating expose on the story, The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit.
And then we go from antisocial, hiding out in the woods, to socialize to a very high degree with Dar Williams, folk musician, environmentalist, and social justice activist, who will make her way to the Eccles stage this weekend to bring her wonderful music and her conversation about what makes a community thrive. Her book is called What I Found in a Thousand Towns, and I'm sure she'll be talking about that this weekend as well. We'll also be joined at some point in the hour by station manager Renee Bodley to talk about next week's KPCW Pledge Drive and some of the highlights that will underscore your desire to support local community radio that brings you great guests and interviews during the public affairs hour, like Michael Finkel and Dar Williams, who we'll speak with after these words when we return. Stay with us. It's The Mountain Life.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doylney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events. Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, ESCO.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney, my co-host. Well, Christopher Knight was only 20 years old in 1986 when he left his family home in New Hampshire and walked into the Maine woods. For 27 years, he had a camp in those woods and eluded everyone who searched for him. He was a true hermit. And what is a true hermit? Well, writer Michael Finkel found out when, after reading the story of Knight's eventual arrest for pilfering food and other supplies, he wrote to him and began to learn his story. Finkel joins us by phone from Bozeman, Montana. Michael Finkel, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me on.
So, The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. What for you makes a true hermit?
I think that's a good question. Now, there's not really any, like, definition or qualification.
Right.
There's no, like, you know, hermits don't, like, carry, you know, hermit cards. you know, essentially, there's all sorts of hermits. It's someone who doesn't really want to spend much time around others. But, when I use the phrase true hermit, Chris Knight had these sort of almost draconian rules. For example, I found it interesting when we were talking that he disliked intensely Henry David Thoreau, someone whose writing I much admire. Why? Henry David Thoreau not only had like dinner parties at his cabin on Walden Pond, his mother did his laundry, but even worse, he wrote Walden, which basically was showing off and bragging about his experience in the woods for other people to learn. He didn't, according to Chris Knight, really become a solitary for himself. He did it for a book to show off to an audience rather than turning away from the world. In a way, he was actively part of it, and that drove Chris Knight crazy. A true hermit is someone who would never write a book about his experiences, never tell anyone about it. And I was very fortunate indeed that Chris Knight spoke with me, and he did not come out of the woods voluntarily at all. And I'm sure into that.
Right, right. Well, Chris Knight, if he's someone who turned away from society, and that's what he felt embodied a true hermit, even though he probably didn't define himself that way. I know that people that you speak to must ask this question over and over. He relied on society to get along with all of his pilfering that he did. How does that fit in?
Well, in a nutshell, hypocrisy, I think, resides within us all.
Yes.
I'm not sure if we've even, you know, the general gist of the book is about a man named Christopher Knight who, at the age of 20, went into the woods of Maine, parked his car deep in the forest, dropped the keys on the center console, walked into the woods of Maine, and wasn't really seen again for 27 years. That's the backbone of the story.
Right.
And you're right. No one really can be completely by themselves for that amount of time. And he did rely in a funny sort of way on society. He, for nurture and for clothing and for things like flashlights and certainly for books, Chris Knight was a thief. He broke into abandoned cabins or second homes along the shores of several ponds in central Maine and took things. And he had a code. He didn't break windows, didn't kick in doors, didn't take your computer, your television, your jewelry, but he still was a thief. And yes, even a true hermit, I guess, can be hypocritical like all of us.
And Michael, you call him the last true hermit. Is he quite possibly the only true hermit? Because you point out that people become hermits for various reasons. I think there were kind of three legs to your stool. One was religious, one was protest, and I can't remember what the third was. But you
maybe artistic or creative, sort of
creative
hermitage.
Yeah, and then you said he didn't fit into any of those, if I'm not mistaken. So because he doesn't fit in, and because he looked at Thoreau and others and kind of found fault with them, would he be kind of the purest or an actual true hermit?
So, I want to make sure I emphasize that, the story and everything I'm talking about tonight is true. This is a true story. It's not fiction or fake news. It's heavily fact-checked nonfiction. However, you're right. There may be, if there's any sentence in the book that may have a touch of exaggeration, it might be on the cover, The Last True Hermit. It's, in fact, I kind of smile wryly and think maybe there's another dude that's actually hidden on the planet longer than 27 years. It's hard to imagine. This is a crowded, interconnected world, ever increasingly so. The likelihood of someone being out there is very, very low. But, Chris Knight, as I mentioned earlier, had a sort of puritanical bent to himself that was almost above and beyond any other hermit I can find in history. Almost all hermits, religious, artistic, protester, otherwise, had someone who knew where they were, checked up on them, brought them food, or occasionally, wandered into town to sell a few things or teach a class. Chris did none of those things. There was a purity to his retreat, despite the fact that he stole that. It almost sounds weird when I say this out loud, but I swear to you, it's true. He is possibly, I feel that I can state he is the most solitary known human who has ever lived in all of human history. Now, there might have been before recorded history or one that we never found out about, but I spent more than a year doing research and never found anyone who was as completely hidden as long as Chris Knight did, and it happened right here, in the 21st century in a crowded country.
Yeah.
And were you able to get from him an understanding of why he did this? I mean, I know enough about your story that he He came from a family where stoicism was admired. They didn't even report that he was missing. I mean, that's kind of incredible, but that says something about the family dynamic he was coming out of and a little bit about himself. But was he able to explain to you why at age 20 he walked into the woods the way he did?
Yeah, Chris Knight, who hid out in Maine, also grew up in central Maine, not too far from his hermitage. He spent 25 of his 27 years living in a single secluded campsite and did come from a very private family, but they were an interesting family. He had four older brothers and a younger sister, and the boys were known as extreme brainiacs in high school. But then more than just book learning, they learned how to fix everything from electrical to automotive to plumbing. The family studied like thermodynamics and theoretical physics and read Shakespeare and poetry at night and had very little money. It was a very interesting upbringing. And yes, you're right, the family did not involve the police. Chris Knight disappeared at age 20, which is sort of considered an adult, and they had no idea where he went to. They didn't even know where to start looking. He could have been anywhere in the world. And I asked the local police officer, you know, don't you find it strange that they didn't call the police if one of my children was missing for a day? They would have every form of authority out looking for them. And the police officer said, no, he didn't find that to be particularly odd. Their keep to itself family, as he said, and in central Maine, as you know, you sort of don't air your dirty laundry. I think they did hire a private detective, but to no avail. Chris Knight was, though not far away, was extremely well hidden. And he asked, why did he leave? And of course, I think that's one of the operative questions. You know, why quit the world? Why would you do that? You know, we know plenty of people that are, you know, socially awkward or shy, and I've felt socially awkward myself many times, and we all do, but you don't quit the world for 27 years. You know, and I asked him this, and Chris said there wasn't a specific triggering event, not a crime he committed, nothing, no, like, I'm leaving now. It was more, as he described it, this sort of gravitational pull to be alone. He never really liked his whole youth through high school being with other people. It always made him feel uncomfortable. It always made him feel as if he was fumbling a social encounter. He never liked it. And he, at the age of 20, I remember being 20 years old, you do some impetuous things. And he drove his car into the woods and abandoned it there. And he was completely unprepared. He didn't know if he would go for a week or a month, and he ended up staying nearly 3 decades. So he left because he just didn't like being around other people, which seems rather a banal or simplistic reason. But I think a better question is, why did he stay? Why didn't he just stay a week or a month? Why did he stay? And I found the answer to that to be a lot more profound and interesting. And in a nutshell, he stayed because he really, really liked being in the woods. It really suited him. It made him feel very satisfied, more than any other place he'd ever been. Chris Knight expressed to me more satisfaction with his extraordinarily outlier life than most people I meet in the world.
Isn't that amazing? Going to, you know, finding the place, it takes most of us a lifetime to find the place that makes us feel most comfortable, most at ease with ourselves and our own skin. And yet, yeah, he found it for 27 years. And then talk about, his capture was kind of interesting, and there were a couple people, at least, that were obsessed with figuring out who this burglar was that had been coming through for, nearly the entire time that he was out there and pilfering, going through cars and taking never anything that was extremely valuable, but things that would help him, that would sustain him in the woods.
Chris Knight, to survive, was a thief and relied, as we mentioned, he talked to, you know, he relied on society on some ancillary or tangential way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't break doors or windows. And funny, when he took things from a cabin, you know, it's not like the computer or your jewelry was missing. He was just taking your hamburger meat, your flashlight, and your Stephen King novel, and he would, sometimes when he was in a cabin, he would pick the locks. He had a Houdini-esque ability to do so. He would make sure the handle to the front door of your cabin was set to lock, so when he closed it behind him, it was locked in, so real thieves couldn't get in. But people did not know. 27 years is a long time. People had no idea what was happening. Things were missing from their cabin. Something was happening. For a while, the theory was maybe there was a gang of teenagers and the initiation rite was to steal something from a cabin. Some people thought it was their neighbors, their own son, out-of-towners. Like, nobody knew. But things were disappearing, and it's one of those crimes that sort of falls between the cracks. You don't call the police and say my Stephen King novel and my flashlight's missing, but everything else is there. They're not going to send a whole team of officers to work on it. But as you mentioned, a local game warden became obsessed with the case. You know, 27 years, it's like, you know, people that grew up with the legend of the North Pond Hermit, as they called him, had kids of their own. And it was like it was the Himalayan Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster, and the North Pond Hermit. And, you know, a police officer, a game warden, became obsessed. And on his free time, you know, wired up the woods with Homeland Security apparatus and caught Chris Knight stealing hamburger meat and cheese from a summer camp that was closed for the season. And you would think that would settle the mystery, but in fact, it was, you know, imagine if a dinosaur did crawl out of Loch Ness or a hairy beast came down from Mount Everest. The truth will make you more freaked out than the myth. It turned out that there was a guy there, and rather than locals being like, ah, now we understand, they were like, we understand less now. But wait a minute, there was a person there? What did he do? Why was he there? What did he learn? What does he have to say to us? Etc. And his capture only enhanced the mystery.
Right. And at what point did you become interested in the story? And this is a whole other part of the story, is your relationship with Chris Knight.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements here. And I do want to also mention that the book is short. It is 191 pages. I have three little kids, and I like to finish my books on one airplane flight. So I kept it short, but there's a lot going on here.
Yes.
You know, there's the you know, the true crime story. There's the intense solitude. There's the myth, the capture, and then you're right, the very profoundly odd semi relationship I developed with Chris Knight. I learned about his story just you know, from my home here in Bozeman, Montana. I read a very small online article from a local Maine paper, and literally every line was like, I don't know if I could believe this. It was like, guys, 27 years alone in the woods of Maine, never had a conversation, never saw the internet, never used any money, never used an indoor toilet, never lit a fire. We're talking about in Maine here. He said he was afraid smoke would give his campsite away. Never saw a doctor and never was sick. Is this even possible?
Yeah.
And so every line I'm reading of this short article is both making me more and more curious and less sure if I could believe any of it. And I waited and waited to see if he would say anything else, but he is a hermit. He said nothing else to the local paper. And after a couple of weeks, I could stand it no longer, and I decided to write Chris Knight a letter. And I did the old-fashioned way. I figured, here's a guy who shunned modern technology. I don't think typing a letter felt right, and I put pen to paper, ink, paper, envelope, stamp, that whole thing, and mailed a note to the Kennebec County Jail in central Maine, and to my surprise and delight, a little bit later, a return note came from him, and that is how our relationship started, by writing letters.
Michael, did anyone make the connection at any point during the 27 years to somebody who had gone missing, some 20-year-old kid who had gone missing, or was it all just a complete amazing surprise to everyone?
Amazing surprise to everyone.
Okay.
Again, Chris Knight's disappearance wasn't particularly a cause celebrated. This was a 20-year-old who actually had been living in Massachusetts and working. His family had no idea that he was in Maine. And so, yeah, nobody knew this person's name or what family he might have come from. It was a complete mystery. And I imagine sometimes the shock that the mother must have felt, I'm sure after a certain amount of time went by in her mind, she just assumed her son was dead. And imagine finding out that he was basically living a half-hour drive away in a tent for 27 years.
And how about, you know, you described his life up until age 20 with a lot of challenges and social anxiety and really a distasteful experience, which is part of the reason that he walked off into the woods, and then he found his place being in wilderness. So I kind of hear you saying it wasn't really to get necessarily away from people, but it was to connect to wilderness. And maybe I'm mistaken about that, but he found the place that he really wanted to be, and he stayed there for 27 years because it was the place. And what about now? I mean, what about now looking back at that? How can he reconcile those two things with being alone in the woods and with the horrible experience he had up until age 20?
Yeah, I mean, when I talk to people about his youth, they didn't particularly say that it was horrible. You know, he was a loner. He seemed to have a few acquaintances, if not somewhat friends, and got good grades, was a good student. But I guess most of his struggles were internal, and it was just more a matter of discomfort. And then, yeah, in terms of, like, finding his place, I think, you know, what are we all looking for? Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. He found his happiness in the woods, and I believe his plan, or what he indicated to me, was that he was never going to come out of the woods. He was going to live there until he died, and no book would ever be written about him, but he was forcibly removed. Well, he committed a crime and was caught. And then, yeah, and then along with all the other elements of the story comes another big thing, which is, you know, what happens to a person who, you know, think about the ages between 20 and 47. That's really the heart, the whole of your life. Before that, you're a kid. After that, you're a middle-aged man. This is the real true heart of his life, is living completely alone with utter autonomy. He's pulled out of this situation suddenly, first locked in a cage with another person. He spent 7 months in jail. They had no idea what to do with him. Do you give him, you know, a huge sentence at the penitentiary? Do you let him go right away? They did not know what to do. He was an outlier in every way, shape, and form, legally, you know, morally, socially, the whole thing. But they released him from jail. And, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but I could tell you that, you know, this is something I was extremely interested in, like how I'm worried about. Like, how is this person who, in the 80s, before the internet, before everything was so fast-paced, thought that society was too overwhelming for him. Mm-hmm. How would he cope with the modern world? And without giving too much away, I could say not very well, but he is a survivor. He is still alive and living in Maine.
And then I know you struggled with this, and you heard a lot of different opinions on the punishment being appropriate to the crime. And some people, well, there were very divergent views on that. And what's your take on his punishment and the crimes that he committed?
Yeah, Chris Knight, as he'll be the first to say, is not a saint. He told me when he instructed me when he knew I was writing about him, which was from the get-go, to take the good and the bad. Don't just make him into some sort of heroic angel. Mm-hmm. And I tried my hardest to write, lay the facts down and let the reader decide how he or she feels about Chris Knight. There was a major debate in the community around Maine about what should be done with Chris Knight. Is there such a thing as an exception to the rules? Just because you've done an exceptional thing, does that give you the right to not be punished to the fullest amount of the law? If you break into someone's house one time and steal a jar of peanut butter, it doesn't matter. You can get 10 years in the state penitentiary for breaking and entering. And he admitted to 1,000 of those break-ins. That's 10,000 years of possible jail time. Some people argue that he should be put away in the state penitentiary for life, no possibility of parole. Other people argued he never had a weapon. He maybe saw one person one time during a burglary. He never took anything of real monetary value. He did take your peace of mind for some people, mm-hmm. which you can't put a price on. And there was even like wealthy people in the community that said, I offer him land to live on and free groceries. There were some people who thought Chris Knight should have no jail sentence at all, should be immediately released. This is not a real criminal. This is not a person who was certifiably insane at all. This was just someone who doesn't fit into our life. Let's let him go back to the forest. He wasn't really bothering anyone. And now we can assure with no thieving he'll bother no one. And literally, we had people who said release him immediately and people who said he should be in jail for life. And neither of those people I could disagree with vehemently. They both had, and of course, all opinions in between. And it was one of the aspects of the story that really that made me more interested, the fact that there were so many divergent opinions, and how you feel about Chris Knight seems to say a lot about who you are, almost more than it says about who he is. And I really appreciated all the different opinions. In the end, he did only serve 7 months. And I guess I don't know what there's an expression, something, you know, a sign of a good deal is when both sides are a little disappointed. And I think if you ask me, 7 months seems very fair, if not even lenient. And so Chris Knight himself expected to spend more time in jail. He was given a very strict probation, which he observed to the letter. And I can tell you that he is a free man today, although maybe not so happy.
Yeah. So he was just in almost the neighborhood of his family home, just a bit of ways. He was in the woods of Maine, which, you know, if you spend a lot of time in the woods of Maine, I'm sure there are many areas that that are primitive, that are wilderness. But, you know, the place that you're from, Bozeman, Montana, I mean, there's more wilderness in Montana than just about any of the states. And I'm wondering about this relationship that you had with Chris, writing the book about him. How did it change your own efforts to be in the wild and exist in the wild and enjoy solitude and that sort of thing?
I think I've always been a little curious about what happens when you spend time alone. I mean, there's really only one person you can ever truly know in your entire life, and that's yourself. I mean, I've been with my wife for quite a while, and every once in a while I'm like, I don't know that about you. You really only know what's going on between your own two ears. We're locked in your head. And most of us are very frightened to spend much time alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the most severe non-lethal punishment in the American penal system is solitary confinement. It is, you know, we are terrified to be alone. It is literally torture. The United Nations has deemed, I think, holding someone alone for more than 2 weeks is considered cruel and inhuman punishment. And this is a guy who wanted to be alone for not just weeks, but months, years, decades. It's very antithetical to most of us. But it's something, you know, as a writer naturally spends a lot of time alone. It's not comfortable, but profound things happen. And in the course of researching this book, I read a lot of other accounts of hermits, religious, artistic, and other all sorts. And they all had very similar things to say about how profound and how interesting time alone is. Not necessarily easy, not mm-hmm. comfortable, mm-hmm. Spending my time with Chris Knight really did change me a little bit, and I'm not recommending that anybody out there go spend 27 years by themselves, but it is shocking how little time we really spend alone. In the course of researching this book, I did an informal, unscientific poll where I asked about 200 people randomly and some friends, you know, what's the longest you've ever gone in your life alone? And what I mean by that is not seeing another person, not making a phone call, not sending a text, not sending an email, just alone, and not sleeping, alone and waking. And 90% of all people, after thinking about it for a while, admit that they've never spent a single day of their life completely alone.
Yeah.
And I found that to be a little startling. We are super frightened to be by ourselves, and yet, you know, some philosophers think that, you know, loneliness is the only true feeling that there is. When we die, we're going to go into death completely alone, and that to be terrified of being alone is to invite terror into your life rather than accepting and understanding. And I don't know, the story of Chris Knight is interesting unto itself, but some of the subjects it brings up are also interesting to mine.
Mm, absolutely. Well, lots to be learned from Christopher Knight about ourselves, as you say. Michael Finkel, the book, The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a fascinating book and story.
I'm happy to have been here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Michael Finkel. Wow, The Last Hermit in the Woods. Are you scared of being alone, Tim?
Not particularly, unless it's dark and I'm in the woods by myself.
I've been alone. I did one trip by myself, a bicycle trip. And I would encounter people every day that I would speak to, but I was alone, and it was mind expanding.
Yeah.
I don't think I loved it.
I
spoke to people. I mean, this guy for 27 years didn't speak to a single person.
That's a whole different kind of alone. Yeah. Your alone and my alone is similar. On a sailboat, I've spent a fair amount of time alone, and I've loved it. I do like being on the water on a sailboat alone. I don't think I'd do it for 27 years where you don't talk to a single person, though.
No.
Only in the apocalyptic aftermath might that be possible for
me. Right. Hopefully we won't have occasion to experience that. Well, here's someone who can talk to other people, and we're going to welcome her on and turn on her microphone. It's KPCW General Manager Renee Bodley. Good morning, Renee, and thanks for joining us for a few minutes here.
Good morning.
The hermit of KPCW.
What? I'm no hermit. I love getting out there and talking. And you two are two of my favorite people to talk to, so thanks for giving me some time today.
So next week is a big week. It's our KPCW Winter Pledge Drive.
Yep, it's a big time for us. We do this twice a year, once in February, once in August. And what I love about our pledge drive is the immense support we get from our community. I'm sitting here with a massive spreadsheet of the local businesses in town who have contributed what we call premiums or thank you gifts to people who call in and make a pledge. And we've got some great stuff here. So when you call in to support KPCW, we do get all of the money that you are pledging. In return, you are getting this thank you gift. And it can be, you know, a $50 gift certificate to one of our great restaurants in town, Eating Establishment 350 Main, River Horse, Maxwell's, Brass Tag. The list goes on and on of the restaurant gift certificates that we have. We also have some ski passes, which are great. And I know what is number one in most people's mind is, what are we going to do for those transportation coupons? Because All Resort Express is sadly no longer in our community, and they were a great supporter of KPCW Radio. They always kicked off our pledge drive with the private SUV rides to the airport and the shared shuttle rides, which you would get. I think normally they're about $90, and you get them for a $75 pledge. So the locals really knew to call in on Monday morning. And we've happily...
I think Alex Butwinski cornered that market, didn't he?
Jan Wilking, Alex Butwinski, yeah. Miles Redman, they tend to call in early. But we're very lucky because Melanie Marier with Canyons Transportation and Sam Rubin with Four Seasons Concierge kind of stepped up and filled that gap. So a big thank you to them. And if you have anything that you want to donate as a thank you gift or donate for our online auction, that's where we put sort of the higher priced single quantity items that we have, like big gift baskets or trips. We have a deadline of 5 o'clock today. So if anybody is listening, please stop by the station or call us or email. And I'm going to throw out Jennifer Kimball Bailey's email address, jennifer@kpcw.org. And we're waiting to take this stuff in. It's going to be a fun week, you guys.
So Monday through Thursday of next week. And, you know, we always say, Renee, that we fill our budget with about 30% of listener donations during these two pledge drives and other times throughout the year, the Broadcaster Club. Is that still the case, especially with federal funding getting cut for things like public broadcasting?
Happily, federal funding has not been cut, but the threat is always there, especially with a Republican administration. They threaten to cut the Corporation for Public Broadcasting dollars all the time. We tend to get the same amount, about $120,000. This year it's $116,000 from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Our goal this pledge drive is $125,000. And last year for our summer pledge drive, we made $140,000. Summer tends to be a little bit higher than winter for us. And together, all of that combined is about 30% of our budget. We do rely heavily on things like Live PC, Give PC, and the Broadcasters Club, which is a club, if you donate $1,000 a year, you get to be part of this really fun social group of people. We go to... First Tracks, we go to Park City Institute. We're going to Dar Williams this Saturday, and you're about to have Woo-hoo. Dar Williams on the air.
We've got her on the line.
Great, so I better wrap up. Please tune in next week for our pledge drive, and thank you, Lynn and Tim, for all you do for the station, too. This is a great show.
Thanks, Renee. We love our show. We really do. We're going to take a quick underwriting break and then be back with Dar Williams. Really excited to talk to her.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Hi, I'm Michael Manning, the Director of Golf at Park Meadows Country Club, proud supporters of KPCW. Our new clubhouse features a year-round golf simulator for practice and lessons. Members are keeping up the sport this winter to prepare for our golf games and tournaments this summer. More info at parkmeadowscc.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Well, our first guest this hour was Michael Finkel with his book about Christopher Knight, the hermit in the woods of Maine. Now we're going to go to perhaps the opposite end of the spectrum to extreme socialization. We bring our next guest, Dar Williams, on. Dar will visit Park City and the Eccles Center this Saturday night. She'll be performing her music and I believe maybe some community building. New Yorker magazine calls Williams one of America's very best singer-songwriters. She has made her career not in massive stadiums, but touring America's small towns. And she has seen what makes those small towns succeed and breathe vibrancy into every community coffee shop, every dog park, every trail. We're happy to have her for a quick preview. Dar Williams, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we're really excited to have you come to Park City. I've got your book sitting in front of me, What I Found in 1,000 Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop, Dog Run, and Open Mic Night at a Time. What a great title and tagline to begin with.
Thank you.
So
yeah, and it sums up a lot.
Yeah, it really does. It does. So when you come to Park City this Saturday, no doubt you'll be playing a lot of your great music, and you have a lot of fans here in this town. And then will you be having sort of a community conversation as well?
Yes, I was invited to do that, I believe, after the concert, which I'm thrilled about. Everybody knows Park City now. Everybody loves Park City. Everybody wants to go to Park City. And that might be something that the residents of Park City want to talk about. So I'm excited to hear what's going on.
Well, Dar, that's a pretty accurate depiction of where we find ourselves in Park City. We have been discovered. And you talk about keeping things local and vibrant and why some towns thrive and some flail. And I think you'll find, and I don't know how much you know about Park City, but you'll find we have a very high level of vibrancy, but we are certainly challenged by that commercialization of what was and has been local. And what have you found in the other towns that you have visited? Is there a common thread that allows those towns to hang on to their authentic local character?
Mm-hmm. There are a few, definitely. And actually, one of the towns that I looked at was Moab, that has about 7,000 residents and 1.5 million people coming through per year. So they've had to sort of struggle to make sure that they are first. And actually, their wonderful mayor said, I put the town first. I do things for the town, for the hospital, for the sidewalks, for the schools. We put the town first, and we assume that the visitors will all benefit from, making sure that our focus is always on the people who live here and, sort of not lying down for the traffic coming through. And I loved that focus. The other thing that I've noticed people doing, in general, when you have these things that I call identity building projects in a town, you look at your food and you look at your history and you look at what in your natural landscape is beautiful. When people get involved with projects that involve the identity of their town, they are able to find one another and sort of interweave and dovetail all their skill sets and learn about each other and learn their strengths and weaknesses and really understand themselves ultimately as a collective. So Moab has a lot of that. I think the people sort of, no matter who you are in Moab, there's some sort of mystical connection to the landscape, and they find each other through that. So that's another thing. And another thing I saw in a lot of towns in Sisters, Oregon, in Moab, is that there are places that are for the residents more first and foremost. Certain cafes, they've got a drugstore that sells tube socks and aspirin. It's not all just cutesy stuff, and that's good. The ordinary stuff for the residents. I've noticed that keeps things feeling very livable, and really helps people know that they're still in a town, no matter how flashy and vibrant and special they are.
And you've kind of dealt with these themes throughout your entire life, haven't you? I mean, some of this could be framed around privilege and non-privilege, or privilege and marginalization, and the relationship between the two and the friction and disrupting that relationship. And my impression is that you didn't sell out to mainstream, and you really staked your claim to a alternative to mainstream, and you've thrived. But maybe that assessment isn't accurate.
Well, I maybe in terms of this book, maybe I'm sort of like a main street of a town. You know, I mean, I have to sort of keep things. I mean, I have a little glitz and I have a little, you know, I know how to put on a, you know, wear things on a stage and be on a stage. But I never succeeded by trying to write things that I thought other people wanted me to write. I succeeded because I wrote about stuff that I saw and thought, oh, gosh, no one's going to like this song, but, you know, it's from the heart. But those were the most popular things that I did. So then I thought, well, okay, that's my formula, you know, sort of staying close to the ground and, you know, at eye level, human scale, all that stuff. And so that was how I built my life. And it wasn't, and again, as you were saying, it wasn't an arena kind of career. It was more of an intimate, you know, downtown kind of thing. So yeah, I got to be kind of a downtown thing, and I got to see a lot of downtown consequently. And I've been watching people for a long time now.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dar Williams. She's written a book called What I Found in a Thousand Towns. To my recollection, this was released about 6 months ago. Is that right?
Right. Yep. September.
Oh, it's such a great book. And so I'm wondering, it's kind of one of those chicken and egg questions. You're known as a folk musician. Does that mean mm-hmm. that there are certain types of towns that have certain types of people as their community members who want to have a folk musician come to town? Or do you ever get invited to these very unlikely towns?
I definitely, well, you know, here's the thing. A town that has, you know, this thing that I noticed in my book, I call it positive proximity, which is this experience of being side by side with other people and that being a positive force. You know, you're not consumed with your own privacy and your own, you know, boundaries. You know, you know that you're going to be living with other people and you're going to be different from them, and that's a good thing. And so towns that have positive proximity tend to have their act together in such a way that they will have some kind of cultural venue, an art center, a community center, or a space that is welcoming to visitors coming through. I say they've got the cultural trade winds blowing through them because they've set up the spaces and their skill sets in such a way that they pull it off. So I do get to see a certain number of towns. It's not really the folk thing. It's just towns that pull off having culture from the outside come in anywhere from 200 to 1,000 people, you know, in a space that they're really proud of. And actually, they're usually, it's not folk. They're very proud of the diversity of their programming. So I'll definitely get to see the cream of the crop in that way, where people have found ways to work together. Like my big motto from the book coming out of it was, the opposite of division is not unity, it's collaboration. So these are towns that know how to collaborate. I'll see a lot of those. But, you know, I pass through a lot of towns where I don't play, and I'll see that same quality. You know, there's a local deli in Findlay, Ohio, where I saw they had advertisers. But they had hand-painted the advertisers on the legs of chairs, on the bottom of chairs, on the pipes, and on all the sponsorship of the local teams and the local projects was written on the ceiling and all over, and you got the sense of the town just from all of this, you know, painting all and the pictures all over the wall. So I'll see it I'll see it everywhere, and I'll feel it everywhere. If in terms of a chicken and an egg, I'll probably tend to feel it, because when you're a musician and you're always looking for inspiration, you're kind of looking for that warmth. You're looking for that feel that I found in all these wonderful places.
Yeah. I just have to quickly tell you about our library in Park City. There's been a recent remodel of this beautiful old historic building. And in it, there's a space for a coffee shop. And there's been some difficulty keeping the coffee shop in there. But recently, there has been a new group come forward that's going to create this coffee shop that'll open next month. It's called Lucky Ones Coffee. and it will be staffed by people with other different abilities. And it was kind of spearheaded by these two young women who work for our local National Ability Center, who do just great programs for people with different abilities and a huge vet program. And so what happened when these two young women proposed this coffee shop was there was this groundswell of support throughout the community from, you know, a contractor and even from people who owned other coffee shops in town. They were like, oh, let us, you know, give you our old, you know, espresso maker and let us coach you on how to be a good barista. And I just thought that there was just this feeling around collaboration, like you say, and community. Yeah. And I'm so excited to see it go. So because you have experience and you talk so much in your book about coffee shops, what would you suggest? You know, what are those elements that for you make a really great coffee shop as a center of a community?
Well, first of all, I have to say big compliments to this project, because it does show what something about Park City, that the fact that somebody, you know, first of all, when you feel like you're invested in a community, you look to the panorama, you know, you take the panoramic shot, you go, how can we make sure that we're letting as many people into this community as possible? I'm so proud to live here. I love it here. I know who does what. We can make things happen and make sure that you know, there aren't people sort of stuck out at the periphery. So that's lovely. And then you also have to have the kind of town that will welcome that project, you know, or a city that will welcome that project and roll with it and groove with it. So that to me says something very wonderful about Park City. But yes, I have strong opinions about coffee houses because that's where I've done a lot of my writing and stuff. And Park City really wouldn't, this wouldn't necessarily pertain, but there are some places where the towns are just kind of getting up to speed. And they'll have an extra room next to their coffee house. I call that a two-roomer. So the second room is where you will have the kid who can sit for 3 hours and write in her journal, and people can have a meeting, and people can have a poetry reading. So I always go for alternative spaces attached to coffee houses, which it sounds like you're going to have there. And I'm a big advocate of toy corners, because that's, you know, all of these very well-connected but very bored parents can meet one another and plan all of their great, you know, events and ideas and things for the school if their kids are occupied. So I love a big, messy bulletin board. I think that gives a sense of the identity of the town and pulls conversations towards towns, which do tend to happen in these public spaces. And friendly staff, if you can pull it off, friendly staff members are so nice. They just give you such a sense of belonging. And I'm always looking for that, you know, a trifecta of some of those qualities.
Dar, I'm wondering if you have seen anything similar to what I think you're going to see in Park City, which is the power of the free market and the private sector and how to harness that. And there's a little bit of a, you know, rub and friction between what you're describing as things that I get a sense are more organic in nature. They grow up from within the community. Even Mayor Dave down in Moab talking about an intentional focus from the local government. We have similar aspects here, but we also have this amazingly powerful free market that could develop things in a very contrived fashion, and that's the commercialization of the authentic local nature. Have you seen that in other places? And I'm kind of wondering about what you've learned from places that maybe haven't thrived and have failed because of those sorts of issues.
You know, something I've learned is that sometimes you'll have a downtown that looks very, you know, $20 beeswax candles and lots of fancy stuff and no snow shovels, aspirin, tube socks, you know, like. And I think that kind of gives the look and feel of things being sort of fake, you know, not real. And but what I've learned is that's not, you know, I went through all these towns that were boarded up in the mid-90s. There was nothing going on. So some of these kind of fancy schmancy things that come in are the pulse of the community because they allow, you know, tourist dollars to come through. They allow traffic and traffic lights and fixing sidewalks and park benches and things like that. So you are going to want this thing that I call visitor viable stuff. And then you're also going to want resident relevance. That's so if there's some way to pay attention to that, somebody said, why can't we bring back more general stores, but not, you know, they can sell artisan things and ordinary things and be a bar at night and something like that. So the 21st century general store could maybe, you know, that all these kids who are starting goat farms, maybe they would want to start a general store. But also philanthropic dollars. I mean, if you're talking about a grander scale, what I love is I've met sponsors of spaces. They'll come in because, you know, meeting the artist is one of the perks of their donations, and they'll make large donations. A lot of times they're sort of shy. They don't have a lot of connection to the town because they have the luxury of not being too connected. They have big properties. And these venues are their ways of belonging in the towns. And, you know, large philanthropic donations and investments from people, it's great for them. It's great for the philanthropists, and it's great for the town. And those relationships, you know, can really be fostered. When people sense that there is that warmth and that commitment and, you know, a community that they love and love to be a part of, they will often want to give to that community on the community's own terms. So actually, I haven't seen a lot of overdoing it. I've just seen towns that sell things that the residents really don't want to buy, and I wish that they could kind of tilt towards selling tourist stuff and the resident stuff. Like yeah. In Tennessee, when I couldn't find an aspirin and I had a headache, and the woman at the visitor bureau said, oh, it's the one thing I would have in this town is a drugstore. So, you know, pay attention to yourself, but, you know, fancy is going to happen. It will keep the economy going, and you do want a downtown economy, you know, in this land of big boxes and internet retail. You're competing with a lot. So fancy will work.
All right. Dar Williams will be performing at the Eccles Center on Saturday, February 24th at 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to hear her music, they've posted on ecclescenter.org a full performance with Radio Woodstock, so you can get a little sample of her great folk music. And we're so excited to have you come. Dar Williams, it'll be mostly about music, a little community conversation afterwards. And thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Take care. We'll see you on Saturday.
See ya.
And that is great stuff. Wow. It's a lot about the wisdom of experience of having touched all of these thousand towns, as she says.
And the synchronicity of her coming to our town right now while we're talking about these particular themes and social equity very much up in the dialogue of the community. I just find that fascinating.
That's right. Let's thank our underwriters, Valley Behavioral Health, Jim Doilney, and Mark Wingsgard with Retail at New Park, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Davidson Orthopedics, Fairway Independent Mortgage, Park City Mountain, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's KPCW, Park City, time now for NPR News.